FW Presents Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is Martin Gray. Hi, Martin.
Hello there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and we're trying something with this little presentation here, a bit of context for this bite-sized podcast. Last April 1st, the Fire and Water Podcast Network issued a collection of failed pilots called Canceled Podcast Cavalcade. The most serious idea it floated was Batman Panel by Panel, in which Ryan Daly and I proposed discussing Batman comics one panel at a time from the very beginning. The format was flawed from the beginning because our experiment showed that even if we did the show daily, 5 years later, we'd still be in the middle of 1941. So, and never mind the sameness engendered within certain eras. But some listeners saw potential in it, and that's where Martin comes into it, almost as a kind of executive producer. Martin, why don't you tell us your vision for panel by panel?
Well, I actually, although, you know, you're given the impression that the three pretendy shows that we had on the April 1st broadcast podcast were failures, I just found them really interesting. You know, short, bite-sized, you know, just one specific panel that you're having a look at, a chance to sort of describe what's there, see how it spins off in the conversation, maybe sort of learn a little bit more about comic art and how it's changed as time goes on. And, okay, yes, obviously, Batman every day for 5,000 years would get a little bit, well, very repetitive eventually after about 2 weeks. But if you're skipping around the history of comics and different comic companies and characters, it could be interesting. I think it's probably worth a try with, you know, different guests. And I'm very, very honored, chuffed a bit to be here today.
And I was charmed by that idea. And I tried to sell it to the to the rest of the network. So this is sort of a stealth podcasting endeavor. It was not greenlit by anyone else. But it's supposed to be proof of concept, maybe. And you'll see, we're not going to get into Batman this time. We're really using the 85 years of prior comic book history. Any company, any title, any characters, any genre could actually have been randomly picked for this. We've set up a randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. To get ready, we rolled up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally, a panel, because we are looking at the discrete comic book unit, the panel. And in this case, we rolled the year 1997, the month of November. Among the 270 comics out that month, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, the revolving finger fell on Young Heroes in Love number 8, which is actually cover dated February of 1998. It is by writer Dan Raspler, penciler Dave Madan, and inker Keith Champagne, with colors by Scott Bowman and letters by Bill Oakley. Then we rolled up a page, page 18 of the 22 available pages, and then panel one of one, because this is a full-page image, a really big panel. And you can see it in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. But first things first, Martin, had you ever read Young Heroes in Love, or is this your first glimpse of the series?
It's not my first glimpse, but I never read it. I remember it coming out at the time and read a little bit of the pre-publicity, and I think it said something like Melrose Place meets superheroes or something, and saw the cover of the first issue, which just didn't grab me. I never tried it. Although down the years, I've been intrigued. And even though I don't believe the heroes have ever appeared since the comic was cancelled after 18 issues and a 1 million issue. And I think that's because they're actually owned by the artist Dev and the writer Dan. And so this was a fantastic chance, an excuse to have a look, because as it happens, 2 years ago, I bought the entire series on eBay. It came to my workplace. It's been sitting in my drawer at work until I knew I had a chance to read it. And so it came out of the drawer this week. And I've now read the first 8 issues, including this panel. And I just love it. I can't wait to read some more.
Yeah, I read it back in the day. And I haven't read it since, but it's been sort of on the docket for a Lonely Hearts episode at some point, because, I mean, it fits that genre as well. I don't think it did so well at the comic book store, simply because superhero fans at the time weren't also necessarily romance comics fans, and this was supposed to be a quirky combination of the two. But yeah, the characters were, you know, interesting, and the whole idea of concentrating on their loves rather than the superheroics, and there was some of that as well, was a fun idea. I love comics that just take the left road where others would take the right one. And Young Heroes in Love certainly did that. And yeah, they are owned by Raspler and Madan, you know, and it's too bad. It means that we haven't seen these guys in the DC universe since, but it also means we didn't get to see them get massacred in some crisis or other.
Spot on.
Yeah, there's good and just there's some bad, and maybe they could eventually, since they own the rights to them, they could go into a sort of indie publishing venture at some point. I mean, it seems like it's been a long time and it's never going to happen, but it could happen.
Well, it could. I mean, Dev Madan does say on his website that he'd love to do something with them, and his website seems like it's pretty up to date. But I mean, I wonder whether they were fibbing in the letter columns, because in the first couple of letter columns they mention that it's done very well. It's gone back to it's been reprinted. The first issue, maybe the first couple of issues, have been reprinted due to demand. And by issue 7 or something, they're saying, you know, we're in no danger at all. And I'm thinking, well, either they're just really talking it up, or something went wrong somewhere down the line. I don't know.
I think maybe there was like a big splash at the beginning, and they did cross over with actual DC characters like Superman in like the third issue, and like this issue that we're covering features the Scarecrow, so you've got a Batman villain. And obviously, this is the reason why they couldn't reprint it themselves at this point, because, yeah. But I certainly like it better than, you know, like a similar project like Sovereign 7 or whatever. So it's too bad that they've fallen out of circulation. Certainly, there's no collection of this. So I'm happy to have the series already in my long boxes.
I'm going to say that it's just amazing. I mean, just reading the DC characters in here with probably, you know, one of the best illustrations of Kalibak from, you know, the New Gods that I've ever seen. And they actually have a crossover with the Genesis. It's pretty good.
And that's not easy.
No, at all. I mean, I doubt they could have managed it with War of the Gods, but, you know, Genesis, I'll take it.
We had no obligation to read the issue or to get a proper context for the image. I will never force that upon a guest. But we just happened to have done so. I mean, this is a series that we had on hand, both of us. So it was like a happy coincidence. And I'm glad that you're discovering it. I want to rediscover it. That's why I want to do a Lonely Hearts episode on it eventually. Because it is a series I remember fondly, but it's been so long. It's been 20 years. So I'm not clear on all the details. But let's look at the panel. Or really a splash page that comes up, page 18, panel 1, because it's the only panel available. You want to describe this panel to us, Martin?
I should give it a go, yes. It's the full page image. It features screaming pop-eyed heroes and hate-filled supervillains. They're all shaped into a monstrous head, its mouth showing fangs created from the skulls on Darkseid's chest. I mean, in the image, you know, you've got the regular cast of Young Heroes in Love, and along with, you know, the villains. At the bottom, you've got, you know, the likes of, you know, Despero, Cheetah, Scarecrow himself, Sinestro, Black Manta, I think Mr. Mixie's picked, like Captain Cold, aforementioned Darkseid, Mongol, and the Penguin. Shout if I've missed anybody out. But you step away from the picture and you appreciate how clever it really is, because it really does, you know, look like a head. You wouldn't necessarily notice the other little heads from a distance across the room, which probably isn't the way to read a comic. But, you know, the hat of that second Scarecrow, you know, forms a horn on the face. Darkseid forms the nose. And I love the colouring. You know, there's a sickly green background courtesy of that colourist, Scott Bowman, who I don't think is the same as Moose Bowman. But it's just normally when you have the Scarecrow in comics, you know, you have a token, oh, I'm scared. But here, the faces are really gnarled and twisted. People look really terrified or shocked or stunned. And it's just got such a lot of impact.
I agree. I mean, one correction, I think that's not Black Manta, but Ocean Master.
Oh, yes. Sorry, Rob.
Despero. Yeah, that's the one I couldn't immediately place. But I do love that it's the Silver Age Sinestro. It's the Golden Age Cheetah. What the... You know, that's the Golden Age look.
I think one of the characters, the fire-powered girl. She's into all the Golden Age heroes, and you know they're her favorites. So that might be why they've chosen that particular one. Bonfire is her name.
Right. That's interesting that it's an amalgamation of various fears that these heroes might have. But it's also the fear that Hard Drive, the leader, has, because this is his encounter with the Scarecrow at the end of the sequence. And we're seeing him watching his friends being, they're in agony, he says. They're terrified. They look like, you know, Monster Girl, kind of, her mouth is so open that she looks like the entrance to a fair ride or something. And what he seems to fear is that his team will never be ready for these big threats, that something bad might happen to his friends. There's something bad's happening now. And then we've got all these other villains in the face of the whatever that creature is supposed to be, the fear creature, the manifestation of fear. And it's like the potential for what could happen to the young heroes in love if they ever meet truly dangerous foes.
That makes perfect sense, because so far in the series, the character Hardwire, who's the leader there that you've mentioned, he has been sort of manipulating the team with his mental powers, but he's also been manipulating the type of activities, the type of crimes and things that they're sort of going up against. So, you know, small crimes, small type of things he's been after so that they can sort of get the publicity. But as it happens, you know, so far, they've actually, you know, the Fort Calabac and the Fort of this fantastic mummy type monster. But I think if he would try and keep things small and just build bit by bit.
So I'm wondering who, I call it a creature, like the manifestation of fear, because it isn't really supposed to be anyone's face. Because I don't know what that, like there's a hood, there's a red hood that transitions into the faces of the young heroes, and that's red. And so that's not the Scarecrow himself, because that's not the rim of his hat. And it isn't any character that we see in the issue or anything. To me, it reminded me of, it's like the optical illusion. What is it? The Charles Allen Gilbert print, where the woman in the vanity mirror.
Oh, yes.
But it looks like a skull from afar. I felt that was like a riff on that idea.
That makes some sense. It's actually also interesting seeing it, the image in black and white. And on Dev Madden's art website, there's a picture of his original art for this issue. One thing that I noticed from the original art that I hadn't actually noticed in the coloured version, on Darkseid's chest, yes, I noticed the skulls and the fangs, but I didn't actually notice the three screaming ghost-type heads right in between them, which I noticed on the black and white version. He obviously thought a lot about how this was going to appear in print, because he put a note on for the colourist, you know, saying to Scott, hold all the line work of the heroes, call if this doesn't make sense, Dev. Which, again, I'm not sure, hold all the line work. I mean, put a colour hold on, I'm not sure whether he did, because it's detoned all the villains in the darkness, which really makes it pop against the heroes. That might be what he meant. But it's just, you know, interesting comparing the black and white one to the color one.
Yeah, we don't necessarily know what the shortcut, the code words between artist and colorist might mean in this case. But yeah, I mean, because the face is so dark, and because the colorist really put like a purples and peach colors in there just to make it very, very moody, you get the sense that the face, it's all part of the same face, while all the heroes are in their normal color schemes, so you can tell them apart. So I mean, I think that's a very interesting way to do it, and maybe it wouldn't have worked without the colorist doing a good job of it.
Well, when he writes, you know, hold the color on the heroes, I thought he was going, meaning, you know, a color hold, which I think is a surprint, like we get in the Who's Who, the original Who's Who.
Yeah.
But obviously, he's gone for the full color, and I think, you know, the artist Dev was saying, you know, if you don't think that's working, you know, just do what you want. And the colorist Scott Baum has just produced some very effective work here.
It's interesting that we get the sketch is online, because it gives us a little bit of insight into how such images are created. So sometimes you'd wonder, without that note, would there have been an original look to it? And then an editor says, oh, that's not clear enough. And then, you know, the colorist has to do it over again. Or we don't know what's going on in behind the scenes. But in this case, there's a real relationship between the penciler and not only the inker, but the colorist as well.
It really seems to have been a passion project for everyone involved. Because, I mean, so far, as I say, I've read 8 issues. And, you know, part of the odd guest artist where Dev Madden's fallen behind. You know, the whole creative team's been the same. So they really seem to, you know, like working on the book, or you know, like the regular wage. But one thing I liked about that You know, when you're quoting the dialogue, you know, my friends, my teammates, they're in agony, the world at their mercy, the innocent, tortured, broken. That strikes me. If it had been a couple of decades earlier, I could really see Roy Lichtenstein stealing this for a piece of pop art, just the over-the-top dialogue and the, you know, the fantastically evocative image.
What really draws my eye is Darkseid in this.
Yeah.
Because Darkseid, with a chest full of teeth, and the teeth are skulls, and the inside the mouth is the like screaming souls. And of course, you've got, it's the 90s, even though this is a much more cartoony style. It's the 90s, so you've got the gooey saliva syndrome. And Frostbite, one of the young heroes, also has it on top there. If you've got Darkseid in your teeth, maybe a, you know, visit to the dentist is indicated.
But there's no fuss powerful enough.
Yeah, that's a fierce image right there. The Darkseid with a mouth on his chest, it's pretty creepy.
Isn't it just, I mean, the one misstep I'd say on the page is nothing to do with it, with the creative team, just the production department. They've left, you know, we've got all the page numbers all the way through, and they've left a little 18 box floating underneath, which a little bit distracting.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not that keen on the greenish background. I don't think it looks as sickly as it does antiseptic. Maybe my dentist joke actually was, you know, comes from that, because it's very fluoride kind of color, more minty than sickly. I feel like the green is like a hospital green.
Oh yeah.
And there's so much of it, because the bottom of the image where that little 18 is, it goes on for a long time. So it feels like if it were, you know, if I just cut off above the 18, there'd be less dead space at the bottom.
Yep.
I probably would like it more, but that's a problem with the size of the page more than anything.
Gotcha, yeah. As you say, it's interesting that, you know, for a comic book that, you know, does use animation style a lot. I mean, Dev Madden, I believe he'd worked on the Batman Adventures comic book previously, contains, you know, this gruesome image. And obviously, you know, we're not talking about other pages, but Whisper, if anyone reads the book elsewhere in the issue, there's, you know, the scariest scarecrow, well, one of them that I've ever seen, you know, not over the top, just pretty darn scary within the context, and contrasting with the cartoony art, animated style art, is just really good. But the one figure in the middle, the character Off-Ramp, the guy with the goggles, he looks a bit like Wolverine or something. It's funny because he looks more like he's just sort of going, "Ooh, I'm on drugs or something, I don't know."
Because we can't see his eyes, I think. Yeah, well, different characters have different fear responses. So yeah, many of them are screaming, but not necessarily. You know, Zip Girl or whatever her name is as the gritted teeth, and you know, so. And I guess Hard Drive is a little more, I don't know, worried, or, I mean, in his eyes, it's almost existential, his fear. So
he's the only one aware enough to be able to actually express himself about it. Everyone else is just so in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Any last thoughts on this panel?
I do like the fact that, you know, you got your little scarecrow looming over in the top corner, sort of, you know, probably laughing at his handiwork. But I just think it's just, I think, you know, the randomizer really came up trumps here, given, you know, all the different panels through the whole series that it could have got, and I guess one of the showiest panels. I just found it a very arresting image, and it just makes me wish, you know, that this series was collected. I mean, hopefully, you know, I wouldn't imagine the next 10, 11 issues will go to hell. I think it'll probably still be enjoyable. And no, I just think it's a wonderful image, and hopefully this podcast will bring it to a few more people's attention, and perhaps, you know, get a few more issues read by people.
Right. Let's hope for that. Thanks, Martin. I wouldn't have done this inaugural episode without you, is the truth of it. But now the panel is open. So if you at home would like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You will be handed a comic book panel randomly, and we'll talk about it for however long we can. Until next time, then, this is goodbye from Siskoid and from Martin Gray. So you can find me at siskoid.blogspot.com. And Martin?
You can find me at the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl and on Twitter at MartGray, MartGray.
Thanks again, Martin.
Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting.
And we'll catch you next time with another panel from the last 85 years of comic book history.